Now, last week you were given a lot of information, more than could be absorbed in the amount of time that we had to do it. But not to worry, we're going to be revisiting some of that information from time to time as we look at these different world religions. But there's one thing I want to revisit as we get started tonight. It's what I told you about the worldview of scientific naturalism based upon the theory of evolution. You remember I told you that the first thing that has to be believed if you hold to that theory is that at some point in the history of the world, there was, after billions of years, there was no life on Earth, and then all of a sudden there was life. In other words, that dead matter became living being somehow, somewhere. There were no eyewitnesses to that event, but it's just assumed to have occurred. And people have built a life view upon it. People like Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and many others write books. They become famous. They make money off of telling people that the fool has said in his heart, there is a God. You know, they take this incident that has been the foundation of the scientific naturalism worldview. That worldview says naturalism means that there's nothing in the world but the natural world. There's nothing supernatural about this world. And scientific means that any knowledge that we have about this world is only real knowledge after it's proved scientifically. But this event that they base this worldview on is something that is a supernatural event. You can take a grain of sand and put it in a petri dish. And after 200 million years, if the petri dish is made out of plastic, the grain of sand will still be there and the petri dish will still be there, but no life will be there unless it came in from outside the dish. This is not something, this worldview is not something that even can be tested scientifically, and it certainly cannot be proved scientifically, but they choose to believe it and build their worldview upon it. Now, if you were to confront these people that believe this with the idea that not 2 billion years ago, not 200 million years ago, not even 2 million years ago, but only 2,000 years ago, a man lived. He lived on the earth for 33 years. He had friends, people that knew him. He also had enemies, so he was killed. But 3 days later, he came back to life. And these same friends that knew him before he was killed saw him after he came back to life. They testified that it was the same man. They testified in writing. They gave eyewitness accounts of seeing this same man. But not only did his friends write that, but other historians wrote that. Jewish historians of the time wrote about the resurrection of Jesus Christ as if it was an actual event. Roman historians of the time wrote about the resurrection of Jesus Christ as if it was an actual event. Now, the probabilities are based upon the fact that this person had been alive and was dead only 3 days. There were eyewitnesses to it, both people that knew him and people that had no reason whatsoever to report this event unless it was true. Now, the probabilities of that event happening are much greater than the probabilities of the spontaneous combustion event. But the atheists, the people that have the scientific naturalism worldview, choose to believe the more unbelievable of the two worldviews. So why is that? Well, the Bible answers that question. It answers it in Romans chapter 1. If you'll open your Bibles here, we want to take a brief look at Romans chapter 1, verses 18 to 32. Should be a familiar passage to most any Bible reader. Romans chapter 1, verse 18. It starts out, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And then the scripture goes on and to describes the mindset of these people that don't believe in God. They didn't glorify God, they didn't give thanks to God, because their thinking became futile. They had foolish hearts who were darkened. They understood from what had been, made so that men are without excuse. They had foolish hearts that were darkened. They became fools. Verse 25 says they exchanged the truth of God for a lie. Verse 28 says they have depraved minds. 29 says they're filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, depravity. Verse 31 says they're senseless, faithless, heartless, ruthless. Now, if we look at Ephesians chapter 4, you don't need to turn there, but it gives us some more descriptions of people that have this same mindset. It says they have futility in their thinking, they're darkened in their understanding. There is an ignorance in them, they have lost all sensitivity. In other words, their minds don't function like God created them to function. They have depraved minds. The people that adhere to these world religions that we're going to be studying have this kind of mind. The people that we meet on the street who have no religion have this kind of mind. And we need to keep that in our minds as we confront these people. Now, what should our mindset be? Colossians 4, verses 5 and 6 says, "Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone." Now, that's how we need to be prepared to confront this kind of mindset, this depraved mind that people have who haven't been born again, who haven't had their minds renewed, who do not have the mind of Christ. Okay, as we approach this idea of world religions, I want to give you an analogy that may help you kind of keep in mind what you're going to be encountering as we look at each religion, how these religions see the cosmos that we live in. Now, the animistic religions, the New Age, the pantheistic, the cults, and the occult that we'll be looking at, see the cosmos as a jungle, with the many trees in the jungle representing gods and spirits. And some of the trees are bigger and stronger than others because some of the gods are stronger than the other gods. Now, Islam comes along and sees all these trees in the jungle and it just levels it, cuts all the trees down, gets rid of all these gods, and it plants one tree right in the middle of the jungle. This one tree they call Allah, representing the one true God. Now, Christianity will come along and see the jungle, and it too will cut down all the trees and plant one tree in the middle of the jungle. But unlike the Islam tree that has one trunk, the Christian tree will grow out of the ground in one trunk, and then that one trunk will split up into three trunks, representing the triune God. Now, Hinduism will approach the jungle, and it will see these trees as trees leading into the one absolute tree that represents the essence of all trees, which is right in the middle of the jungle. These will just help you get there to this absolute, ultimate consciousness of trees. Now, Buddhism will approach the jungle, and it will not pay any attention to the jungle. It will start building a road around the jungle, a road called the Eightfold Path. The Eightfold Path to liberation. Buddhism will say, you can go into the jungle if you want to and mess with the gods, but they won't get you any further along the Eightfold Path. You're just wasting your time there. Confucianism and all the Oriental religions that we'll be looking at they look at the trees and they see the trees as real trees, and they'll be concerned about the ethical treatment of the trees. So that gives you kind of an idea of the approach of each of these religions to the cosmos. But tonight we'll be looking at Buddhism. And according to your handout there, if you look at that, Buddhism, the word jnana in the Sanskrit is the word that's translated as Buddhism, and it means vehicle or ferry. Buddhism is the vehicle or ferry that carries you out of the cycle of reincarnation, away from attachment to the world, to enlightenment, and ultimately to nirvana. And the name Buddha means enlightened one. So Buddha, the enlightened one, is the end goal. Buddhism is the ferry or the vehicle that's supposed to take you to enlightenment. Now, Buddhism has a founder. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, and he lived approximately 560 BC to 480 BC. And sometime around 525 to 530 BC is when he started on his religious trek. As far as scriptures are concerned, the main Buddhist scriptures are called the Tipitaka, which means three baskets, and is sometimes referred to as the Pali canon. The Pali is the ancient Indian language in which they were written. And it's called three baskets because it has three types of text in it. It has rules for monks and nuns, it has sutras, Buddha sermons, and it has commentaries. Now, the Buddhist scriptures are not law. They are recommendations of how to reach enlightenment. Supposedly, Buddha's dying words were, "Work out your own salvation with diligence." Because he left no writings, and because so many centuries had passed before his teachings were written down, much of what has been written about him has been projected back to him, causing his image and legacy to grow to fit the changing times. Current books on Buddhist philosophy impose some of Einstein's theory of relativity and quantum physics into Buddhist teaching, which doesn't seem likely, but that's what happens when you don't have a written record. The Three Baskets was written 500 years after Buddha lived. Buddha himself left no writings. His followers met, they had councils, two or three of them, within this 500-year period, but it wasn't until around the first century A.D. that anything that he taught got written down. And this is what they understand about Gautama's path to enlightenment. He was born in a palace in northeast India. His father was a wealthy member of the ruling class, a warrior class, and he wanted his son to follow in his footsteps. He wanted his son to be a wealthy ruler. So in order to try to head him in that direction, he kept his son very protected as he was growing up. He gave him only the luxuries of life, never let him see any of the bad side of life. He didn't want his son to leave the palace at all. But when Gautama was about 30 years old, he saw four things that changed his life. He saw an old man that was crippled and bent over, leaning on a walking stick. He saw another old person that was sick with a debilitating disease lying on the side of the road. He saw a corpse lying on the side of the road. And his driver, who was driving him around, explained to him that that's what life was all about. That eventually we all end up old, sick, and dead. Before he got back to the palace, he saw another vision. He saw an emaciated old holy man who seemed to be happy. So when Buddha got back to his palace, he was thinking about these things, and he decided that the way of the holy man was the way of happiness. So he decided then and there that he was going to leave the palace. He had a wife by this time and a son. He left them. He started on his search to find the way to overcome sickness, death, old age, all the sadness, all the pain of life. He started on his road to enlightenment. What he had lived in seemed a hollow shell for him, because he realized that surely as day follows night, that no matter if you're rich or poor, you're still going to suffer these things. And he wanted a way to avoid that. So he shaved his head, put on a simple robe, took out a begging bowl as his only possession, and started out to follow the footsteps of the holy man. He took up with some hermits, stayed with them for a while, then he went into a forest and met some real ascetic monks who were there that were living a real life of deprivation. He stayed there for several years, eating very little. He was quoted as saying that he could touch his stomach and feel his backbone. At one point, he grew so weak that while standing close to or next to a river, he just passed out and fell over into the river. Well, falling into the water kind of revived him, and he pulled himself up on the bank. And about that time, somebody came along with some food and fed him. Well, his disciples saw him eating, and they immediately deserted him. They thought that that was just a horrible thing for him to be doing. But Buddha came to the conclusion that the ascetic life was not the way, the luxury life was not the way. There had to be a middle way. So he decided to go out and find this middle way. So he sat down under the Bonsai tree, the great symbol of Buddhism, the Bonsai tree. He was going to sit there until he got it all figured out. And while he was sitting there, legend has it that this demon called Mara appeared to him and tried to tempt him out of this quest to find enlightenment, to find the way out of pain and suffering in the world. But he was able to overcome this temptation and stick to the task of sitting there and trying to figure out a way around the pain and suffering of the world. He had some monumental insight that left him in a position of being able to leave behind all the desires of the world, the emotions. And he gained an insight into the karmic chains that kept him tied to the cycle of death and rebirth. Finally, in a radiant state of super consciousness, he perceived the interdependent state of the universe, the law of causality, and intuited the way for mankind to free himself for suffering. And so, Gautama attained enlightenment, becoming a Buddha, the first Buddha, the enlightened one. And then he had a problem as to how to communicate this great insight that he had to others. Now, how do you describe the indescribable? Well, he had another vision sitting there. He saw mankind as a lake full of lotus blossoms and different stages of ripening. Some of them were down under the surface of the water, still trying to make their way out of the mud and the darkness of the water. Some of them were almost in full bloom, floating on top of the water. So he realized that some of mankind are mature enough spiritually to understand his teachings, and they in turn can turn around and help those who are still trying to come up out of the darkness, those who follow behind. Now, that's where the Buddhist symbol of the lotus flower has meaning to the Buddhist, because of this vision that he had about mankind. And that's basically how Buddhism got its start. Now, your next item on here is a geographical spread and divisions. About 100 years after the death of Gautama Buddha, there came divisions over his teachings, and like all world religions, they eventually divided up into different schools as Buddhism developed and spread geographically. Now, I've listed on your sheets some of the main ones that we'll just look at briefly. Mahayana, remember the ending Y-A-N-A means vehicle. Mahayana is the greater vehicle, and it stresses compassion and service to others as the way to enlightenment. You'll find this one in Tibet, Mongolia, China, Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. Hinayana is the lesser vehicle, and its mode of practice is detachment and seclusion and renunciation of the world. You find it in Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. Diamond, it means unsplittable. This is what I call fast-track Buddhism. You can reach enlightenment in one lifetime in this form of Buddhism through uses of visualizations, incantations or mantras, hand gestures and rituals that can only be learned from a master. Then we have Pure Land Buddhism. It offers a way to enlightenment for people who cannot handle meditation, endure long rituals, or even just live an especially good life. Devotion to Amitabha, a Bhagavata who resides in the Pure Land, will result in being reborn in the Pure Land. In other words, you've got to follow the right master. If you follow his teachings, the one who lives in the Pure Land, you will be reborn in one of your cycles of incarnation, be reborn into this Pure Land. And once you reach the Pure Land, you're guaranteed an easy step to nirvana from there, the final destination. Okay, the next one down there is Tibetan. This is the one that probably gets the most press, the Buddhism of Tibet. It came from China, and in Tibet it developed its own expression of Buddhism by mixing with the natural religions of spirits and demons in Tibet. You find it in Nepal and the Himalayan regions of India and Mongolia. And of course the face that we see to Tibetan Buddhism is the Dalai Lama. Dalai Lama is a title given to the leader of Tibetan Buddhism. Dalai means ocean of wisdom. Lama means superior one or highest one, highest being, not like in a god, but the highest being that you can attain in this life. So that the Dalai Lama is the highest wisdom of anyone that's available in the human being's life. This title was conferred on a spiritual leader by a Mongolian prince in 1578. Now the Dalai Lama is not a Buddha, but the embodiment of a certain Bhagavata. Dalai Lama does have a name. The current Dalai Lama does have a name, as they all do. They're just people. He was born as Tenzin Gyatso. He was recognized as being the reincarnation of his predecessor when he was 2 years old. And when his predecessor died, he became the Dalai Lama. You remember, or some of you will remember, that China began its takeover of Tibet in 1949. And when they took over Tibet, they very shrewdly allowed the Dalai Lama to be the sovereign ruler of Tibet. Well, the Dalai Lama was 15 years old at the time. Well, boys grow up, and 9 years later, when the Dalai Lama was 24, the people of Tibet rose up in a popular rebellion to try to get rid of the Chinese occupiers. Well, in that rebellion, about 90,000 Tibetans were killed, and the Dalai Lama escaped to India, where he has been in exile ever since. Now, you also might remember that in 1998, he received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts for trying to get the Tibetan people liberated from Chinese rule by using nonviolent means. And I think wisdom would tell us that nonviolent means are the only means that the fly has when he's dealing with an elephant. So violent means wouldn't work anyway. But that's the Dalai Lama story. That's where he came from. That's where he is. That's his story, and he's sticking to it. Okay, the last one we're going to talk about is Zen Buddhism. And again, that's one that may be familiar to a lot of you. This is the mystical school of Buddhism. It spread to Japan from China, and China is called Chan. And this is the Buddhism that's making a lot of inroads into the West. Zen Buddhism came into its own in Japan with the rise of the samurai warrior class in the 12th and 13th century. The life of the samurai could be abruptly cut short on the battlefield, so it was imperative that he could obtain enlightenment as quickly as possible. And the instantaneous route offered by Zen Buddhism was very attractive to the samurai. The stillness of mind that Zen meditation taught was considered to better equip the warrior in the battlefield. They saw little difference between the physical skills of the combatants, but the ability to concentrate and stay focused on the movements of your opponent would give you an edge in a hand-to-hand combat. You see that in the movies a lot, these kung fu movies and things. And incidentally, the samurai Buddhist are where the statue of the Buddha comes from. I'm sure you've all seen the statue of the little pot-bellied Buddha that sits around. Well, the real Buddha was not pot-bellied at all. Now, he lived a lot of his life in a very emaciated condition, but even when he started on the middle way and started eating again, he never was overweight. He never was... He took care of himself, according to all reports. He was trim. He never had this pot belly. But the samurai do. So they made Buddha into their own image. And the world has accepted it. Zen assumes that anyone can experience enlightenment without fasting or castigating oneself. It can come without warning. The purpose is to attempt to understand the meaning of life directly without being misled by logical thought, reason, language, or appearance. Now, Zen offers two methods to enlightenment. One is pure meditation, which is a mystical approach of self-emptying of the mind. And the lotus position is the best position to meditate in to obtain this. The other approach is outward through interaction with a Zen master. And this involves meditation on puzzling and paradoxical statements made by the master. In Zen, practitioners aim to consciously disrupt understanding and logical thinking in order to allow great emptiness to gain entry. You must give up a dualistic view of the world, the idea that contradictions exist. Now, the first law of logic is the law of non-contradiction. And that says two propositions that say opposite things cannot both be true at the same time. Now, you can say it's raining, and you can say it's not raining. But they cannot both be true at the same time, except maybe here in Aberdeen. But the idea is that it's either one or the other. But Zen says it can be both. Both can be true. The aim of Zen is to completely demolish the way humans think, the logical way we think, the way God made us to think. The puzzling and paradoxical statements the Zen masters use are called koans. It's spelled K-O-A-N, koans. And they're used by the masters to help break the mind of their students. And the most famous koan is, you know the sound of two hands clapping. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Well, enlightenment could come suddenly and could be reached if the student could raise the question, what is the sound of one hand clapping, to the level of emptiness? But think about it. No, don't think about it. You've got to empty your mind. But if your mind is empty, sound of one hand clapping is there. Not true. That's Zen Buddhism. If you say to a Buddhist, you're out of your mind, they would take it as a compliment. Another example of koans, a student asked his master, how old are you, master? The master replied, 7 times 9 equals 68. The student said, master, how can 7 times 9 equal 68? The master said, I deducted 5 years for your sake. Okay, I'll let you think about that a minute. Did you get it? Okay. I'll give you a couple more. Another one of the questions I like to ask is, what is your original face before you were born? Now, obviously, this was said before the invention of ultrasound. Okay? The master had a visitor who came in to inquire about Zen. But instead of listening, the visitor kept talking about his own ideas. After a while, the master served tea. He poured tea into his visitor's cup until it was full, and then he kept on pouring. Finally, the visitor could not restrain himself. "Don't you see it's full? You can't get any more in it." So the master replied, "Just so. And like this cup, you are filled with your own ideas. How can you expect me to give you Zen unless you offer me an empty cup?" Okay. One day, a master stood outside the gate. Someone says to him, "Why don't you enter?" He says, "I do not see myself as outside. Why should I enter?" Okay. Not to be outdone, someone has posted Christian koans to the internet. Okay, a man came to a believer and said, "You say that you know God exists. Prove it to me." The believer said, "Do you have any matches?" "Yes." The believer took a napkin and soaked it in water. "You say that you have matches. Set this napkin on fire." Okay. A novice closed his eyes, folded his hand, and began to say, "Our Father who art in heaven." A master said, "What are you doing?" "I'm assuming the right position and saying the right words to pray." "You can't pray by assuming a posture and taking a specific set of words." "Then how do you pray?" The master closed his eyes, folded his hands, and began, "Our Father who art in heaven." Are you getting the gist here? A novice said to a master, "I want to be totally devoted to God. Tell me how I should talk, how I should dress, how I should act." The master said to the novice, "I want to be spontaneous. Tell me how I should plan my day." A novice handed the master a check, saying, "Here is some money so that you will be happy." The master put the check into the fire. "I wish the fire to be happy also." Okay. Well, I have one more to share with you. It's my favorite. If you have some ice cream, I'll give it to you. If you have no ice cream, I'll take it from you. That's an ice cream cone. Did you see that coming? No? Okay. Other methods used in Zen Buddhism include beatings and kickings. Yes, Buddha never said the path to enlightenment would be easy. Some schools of Zen take the approach that 30 blows when you have something to say, 30 blows when you have nothing to say. The student has to be shocked out of all he has learned, experienced, and all previous conditioning. A blow to the back or the slap in the face may be just what he needs. Well, if you haven't seen by now, Buddhism is full of contradictions, but that is to be expected because the essence of Buddhism is contradiction. Buddhism means enlightened one. You become enlightened so that your light can be extinguished in nirvana. If you think you have reached nirvana, you haven't, because you're still conscious of thinking. So how does one know when he's arrived? The next thing on your outline here is Buddhism by the numbers. You see on the other side of your handout that there's a list. If you want a religion of being able to keep a list and do things, then Buddhism may just be for you. Besides the 9 things on the other side of your handout, they have 10 vows, 6 conditions of rebirth, 6 possible paths to nirvana, 3 aspects of faith, 20 difficult accomplishments on the path to enlightenment, 5 things no one can accomplish in this world, 4 unlimited states of mind, 4 viewpoints to consider, 5 faculties of power needed on the path to enlightenment, 6 practices for realizing enlightenment, 7 kinds of acceptable offering, and in the political science arena, they have 7 principles necessary for a nation to prosper and 5 principles of justice. So if you're a listless person, Buddhism is there for you. Now, looking at their basic beliefs, I've listed some of the key words down there. There are four noble truths and an eightfold path, which we'll look at a little later. Maya is the Sanskrit word for this world of illusions, deceptive condition of the world of illusions. Karma, actions in this life, are causal to the conditions of the next life. In other words, if you do more good deeds than bad deeds in this life, your next life will be better than this life. If you do more bad than good, then your next life will be worse than this life. Dharma are the teachings of the sublime truths from the Buddha. Reincarnation, the cycle of rebirth into this world, each being different. Enlightenment is insight into the suffering of life and the way out. This Pachavita that the Dalai Lama is a reincarnation of, and some of the other revered Buddhists. He's an enlightened one who postpones nirvana in order to help others reach enlightenment. In other words, this is a person who could go into nirvana when he dies, but he chooses not to. He stays behind to help others. He's a self-sacrificing kind of person. The Sangha is the organized assembly of the Buddhist monks, the Buddhist community. And Nirvana means extinguished. It's a state of ultimate clarity and motionless silence and emptiness. So those are your key terms for Buddhism. And I've given you a little phrase down there that might help you. It's kind of Buddhism in a nutshell. A person who brings his karma into agreement with Dharma will reach nirvana. And that's basically what Buddhism is all about. Now, if you look at the back of your sheet, at the four noble truths. Now, this was the enlightenment that Buddha received when he was seated under the Bonsai tree. Life is suffering. The cause of suffering is desire. Cease desiring to cease suffering. Cease desiring by the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path is the key to enlightenment. Now, I've given you the Eightfold Path there. Right views, right thought, speech, conduct, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and concentration. Now, right views, Buddha understood means to thoroughly understand these fourfold truths, that this is the way out of the pain and suffering of this world. Cease desiring. You have to believe in the law of karma, and not be deceived by appearances and desires. The world is an illusion. That is the right view of Buddhism. Right thought means freedom from lust, desire, cruelty, greed, anger, and ill will. You're to seek release from these things. Right speech means abstaining from idle and abusive talk, deceit, slander, and profanity. Talk only of the Eightfold Path for release. Right conduct means not stealing, killing, or committing adultery. Do what helps along the path to release. Right livelihood, not talking about how you make your living, but how you live your life. Right livelihood, avoiding a way of life that is shameful to oneself or harmful to others. Act and think morally. Right effort, diligently trying to avoid evil thoughts and to entertain good thoughts. I commit all of my actions to this one goal of enlightenment. Right mindfulness, to maintain a constant vigil on the state of one's mind, body, and emotions. And right concentration, employing meditative techniques to keep the mind tranquil and focused, free from defilement, and ready for enlightenment. I practice meditation in order to achieve release. Now, according to Buddha, I quote, following the Noble Eightfold Path is like entering a dark room with a light in the hand. The darkness will all be cleared away and the room will be filled with light. And then I add, and in nirvana, the light goes out. Nirvana is a total extinguishment of life, of consciousness, of existence. Okay. Okay, we're going to hurriedly look at the religious dimensions of the Buddhist worldview. Like all Eastern religions, Buddhism is hard to grasp in its entirety because its fluid view of the universe gives rise to a fluid religion. Nothing is set in stone like the Ten Commandments were. In the experiential dimension, experience is inward rather than outward, with a goal of perfect quietness. This is opposite to the dynamic experience of the numinous that we talked about last time. Yoga meditation is mystical and non-dual, trying to do away with the subject-object relationship, meaning I'm here, you're there. Yoga means yoking or joining. And it's talking about joining everything into a universal consciousness in Hinduism and joining everything in a universal emptiness in Buddhism. It's a feel-good religion, as all thoughts of pain and suffering are put out of the mind. In the mythical dimension, there are a lot of legends and things associated with Gautama himself, but remember the mythic dimension are overall arching stories that help explain the universe as part of one's worldview. Now, Buddhism has no overarching mythic stories that tell about the universe. The Buddhist view of the universe is that it's all illusion, that it doesn't really exist, so why explain it? So the mythic dimension of the religious, mythical dimension of the religious experience of Buddhism is pretty much non-existent. In the doctrinal dimension, Gautama did not intend to start a new religion, but as he thought things through, he had some problems with certain Hindu beliefs. He rejected the Hindu idea of an ultimate universal consciousness that all should join into. He also rejected the idea of an eternal soul. Instead, he saw everything as ultimately empty, and we should seek to join into that emptiness in the state of nirvana. Instead of opting in, we should opt out. It is strongly doctrinal, as you can see by Buddhism, by the numbers over there, and plays down the mythical role. It pays much attention to the analysis of things and persons. Nature of existence is summed up in the three doctrines. Everything in the world is impermanent. Everything is without self. Everything is full of suffering. Everything is short-lived. Buddhism is meant to make you look at the world in a way that recognizes its emptiness, and that there is nothing solidly satisfying that's worth grasping onto. In the ethical dimension, major religions all have common moral codes, and they all share that, not to steal, kill, or lie, have certain kinds of sexual relations. They're common to all major religions. The details vary a little bit. In Christianity, you're allowed one wife. In Islam, you're allowed up to four wives. In Buddhism, the rules of morality are part of this Noble Eightfold Path, which leads to ultimate liberation from this life. Buddhism does not have a god to be obeyed, but that in the general effort of self-perfection, it's the wise thing to be good, to do good. It helps you in the next life. In the ritual dimension, again, emphasis is on the inner feeling rather than outward formality. The pious Buddhist pays reverence to the relic of Buddha, the statue, but only because it puts him into a better frame of mind. It helps him remember the path that Buddha trod. That's the path that he wants to go down. So he looks at the statue, and it's an encouragement to him to help him focus on his aim while he's meditating. They're not worshiping Buddha because Buddha has ceased to exist in nirvana. They're not worshiping God because God does not exist. So ritual in Buddhism is not a worship, but it's a tool toward the inner and upward path to enlightenment. Ritual has a utilitarian value in Buddhism. In the social dimension, remember the social dimension is the religion's influence on society as a whole, as well as the social community that the individual adherent is into. As far as Buddhism's influence on society, The question has to be asked, to what extent has Buddhism's emphasis on the mind and the analysis of true reality helped the economic miracle of Japan in the last 50 years? There's no doubt that the Japanese can analyze things and they can improve on things. And they've become the richest nation in the world per capita because of that ability. So how much of that can be attributed to the mind practices of Zen Buddhism? In the individual dimension, there's reinforcement in the Sangha, the Buddhist community. Most communities that have any number of Buddhists will build a temple. The temple will have a master in it, and the practitioners can go there for instruction, for fellowship, and for meditation. Buddhism's growth in the West reflects its responsiveness to the needs and worldview of the West. Buddhism gives religious underpinnings to the angst or the feeling of desire that is so rampant today. Buddhism affirms that life really is pain and suffering, as it is for so many people, and meaningless, as it is for so many people. It provides a painless way of escape. It is a religion that poses no threat to others, and therefore is socially acceptable and politically correct. Buddhism works like a mind drug. It offers a way of escape from the pain of life. It serves the same purpose as drugs and alcohol. Overindulgence in Buddhism will not make you violent or abusive. Buddhism is against that. But any indulgence in Buddhism can cause you to lose touch with true reality. I'm going to quickly give you some parallels between Jesus and Buddha. The Buddha legends have it that when Gautama's mother was pregnant with him, some kind of being appeared to her and told her that her son was going to be a great spiritual leader, much like the same vision that Mary had. Jesus left the glory of heaven, came to earth and lived a very simple life. Gautama left the glory and the riches of the palace life to live a very simple life. Both of them started out in their ministry at about 30 years old. Both of them were tested, Jesus by Satan in the wilderness, Gautama by this Maya demon under the Bontai tree. Both had disciples. Both had their disciples abandon them at a point in their time. Neither one had a wife on their religious journey. Neither one left any writings or their teachings. Both were considered to be wise teachers. Neither had intentions to start a new religion. Now, Jesus came to fulfill the law. He wanted to reform Judaism to back to what God wanted it to be. Gautama wanted to reform Hinduism. So we have these parallels, but the parallels collide. The Sermon on the Mount tells us that the disciples of Jesus become the light of the world. The disciples of Buddha have their lights extinguished in nirvana. I also want to give you some points of contact with Christianity. So one, of course, is meditation. Are we to meditate to empty the mind or to fill the mind? Buddhism says, distinguish all thoughts. Christianity says, whatever is true, noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Buddhism's last words were reportedly, work out your own salvation with diligence. That ought to sound familiar to you. Christianity says, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. Philippians 2:12. And Buddhism says to work out to attain your salvation. Christianity says to live out what has already been obtained as a free gift. Now, the words attained and obtained are important here. We're living out our salvation. The Buddhists are trying to work for theirs. Buddhism offers us an escape from the world. Christianity offers victory over the world. Then we have this idea of enlightenment versus the peace that passes all understanding. We have the Eightfold Path of right doing and being, which does not recognize the fall and the sinful nature of man. Man cannot do right until he is right, until he's made a new creature in Christ. Buddhism is a mind drug that offers escape from the pain and suffering of the world. Christ makes all things work together for good. The Bible tells us that these light and momentary afflictions that we have are working for us and not against us to produce an eternal glory. Now, Buddhism says that the pain and suffering of life is a bad thing and we should try to avoid it, escape from it. God says it's a necessary thing and He uses it for our good. The goal of Buddhism does not match with the reality with which we have to live. In reality, even the enlightened Buddhist doesn't just disappear. Their lives are not extinguished. They still have to deal with these heavenly messengers that Gautama saw. They have to deal with old age, sickness, and death. But are these just illusions? Well, if so, they call for an illusion of a walking stick, an illusion of medicine, and an illusion of a grave. In 2 Corinthians 4:6, we read, "For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made His light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." And that, my brothers and sisters, is true enlightenment. The enlightenment that comes from being a Christian, being rightly related to God, having His wisdom, understanding the reality of this world, understanding that this world is here for our benefit, understanding that we have overcome the world, understanding that we're not to escape, but we're to be used of God while we're here. We're here to do His will. And our glory will come later in the next life. Okay, I've given you two questions for your discussion. Last time we went a little longer, and I still went a little long today, and cut into your tea time, so I only gave you two questions. You can discuss them as long as you like. You can discuss them over tea, or after tea, or before tea. Thank you very much.